Okay, so my talk is I'm hoping to give you some feeling for cluster surveys, and in particular address the issue of whether we might hope to do precision cosmology at the level of CMB anisotropy cosmology with cluster surveys. So first I'll focus, probably most of the talk will be focused on cluster survey yields, because if we can understand how we calculate the yields we expect from the cluster, then all these other bugaboos might come up. I'll focus on the cosmological sensitivity, dark matter versus the intercluster medium. I'll argue that dark matter is pretty well understood, dark matter properties of clusters, but it's the ICM that we have problems with. And then I'll show you some observations of real clusters that make me optimistic. Talk very briefly about two test cases and basically point you to a paper where it's discussed in more detail. And then I'll end with some preheating simulations similar to Martin's, where I'll discuss pseudo-quantitatively some potential limits on precision from these preheating effects. So galaxy cluster surveys probe the volume redshift relation. They probe cluster abundance evolution, and they probe, of course, they're sensitive to cluster structural evolution. I have some surveys listed here, some surveys that have already taken place. X-ray surveys of the local universe, optical surveys include an X-ray flux limited sample of 55 brightest clusters. That this particular edge sample shows up again and again in cluster work. There's the ROSET all-sky survey, and there's follow-up being done on that. And this reflex survey by Gutzo and Boehringer has many hundreds of clusters, so that'll be eventually quite an interesting sample of clusters. There are intermediate redshift cluster surveys as well. The most well-known X-ray survey is the EMSS survey, the Einstein Medium Sensitivity Survey or something like that, done mostly by Pat Henry and collaborators Isabella Joya. And then there are recently PSPC, ROSET PSPC archival studies, which are pushing to high redshifts. There's a group, not this McLennan group from the CFA, but a group which includes Lawrence Jones and some people who's from Britain and some people from Goddard, where they're actually sort of looking for serendipitous cluster sources in the PSPC archive. And they've found about 5 clusters at redshifts around 0.8, and they're all quite luminous clusters. So that's very interesting stuff. So planned surveys to intermediate and high redshift are, there are a lot of optical surveys. The most, SDSS is a very large survey, which will provide thousands and thousands of clusters. Jim Annis and his buddies, just using a couple hundred square degrees of commissioning data from Sloan, have created a list of a few thousand clusters. And eventually, the survey, of course, will cover 10,000 square degrees. I guess Dick Bond mentioned this University of Toronto survey where they used the ES0 ridge, the color magnitude relation for early type galaxies, to find clusters. That's a promising approach. We'll talk about what I see as limitations in optical surveys. There are large solid angle X-ray surveys. The one that's for sure to happen, unless there's some disaster with XMM, is just a serendipitous survey using the XMM archive. And Kath Romer has estimated that we should be able to get about 4,000 clusters out of that. So this is the size of the Bell catalog, which is the catalog of local clusters found in the optical. So this is quite an amazing sample. This is a proposed X-ray mission, which may or may not be accepted, which would deliver about 10,000 clusters over the whole sky. And then, of course, what we're here to talk about are SZ surveys, both bolometric and interferometric. And I don't mean to leave anyone out here, and I'm sure I have. That's a reflection of my ignorance, not any sort of intent to leave anyone out. The one that I know about that sounds quite exciting is Bill Holtzeffel's ACBAR survey, which should be happening on a short time scale. Bolocam, Sandy Lang and friends, has already taken data. I think Bill is going to talk today about a large solid angle, relatively shallow SC survey, but deeper than this ACBAR survey. Of course, there's the Planck survey. I think there's a talk on that. And then there are interferometric surveys. There's one proposed by John Carlstrom that does surveys about 12 square degrees. This is a far more sensitive survey than any of these, with the possible exception of Bolocam. And the Ryle group and is also talking about this kind of a survey. I think we'll hear more details about that later. And the Taiwanese group also is going to carry out an interferometric survey, and they have $15 million to do that already, so they should be taken quite seriously. So how do we estimate cluster survey yields? Well, you can calculate the cluster redshift distribution, dndz within some solid angle d omega, and it's simply the volume element that you're surveying times the abundance of detectable clusters. So it's an integral from your limiting detectable mass to infinity. So typically you detect all clusters above some limiting mass. Let's talk about that in more detail. So on the volume issue, a cluster survey in its pure sense is, or maybe too simplistic a sense, is the classic volume redshift test or the Tolman test. If we had some tracers in the universe whose density remained constant over time, then we could just, if we could detect them, we could count them as a function of redshift, and we could measure the volume that we were surveying as a function of redshift within the volume per solid angle as a function of redshift, and that's very cosmologically sensitive. Now, of course, clusters aren't tracers whose number density remains constant over time, and so we have to account for the abundance evolution of galaxy clusters. The fact that density perturbations are growing over time, they're being amplified by gravity. And so this turns out to be a trick in or a challenge, let's say, in estimating cluster yields. Now, if you want to estimate the how this abundance is evolving over time, one way to do it is to use the standard Press-Schechter formalism, which we saw discussed yesterday. Typically people normalize locally, meaning you use the local observed abundance of clusters or number density of clusters above some temperature threshold or mass threshold, and then you you can use that as a normalization, and you can predict, given any cosmological model, what the abundance will be at any given redshift using the trick is really just how this sigma is evolving over time, how the RMS density perturbations on a mass scale m, how that's evolving, how gravity is amplifying the density perturbations. That's the whole trick. Now, Press-Schechter should just be viewed as a convenient, reasonably accurate, and vintage approach. It's been compared to simulations in great detail, and I don't want to talk about that in any detail here. Just want to mention that some recent improvements include a consideration of asphericity on the timescale of collapse by Sheth Moe and Torman. And then recently, the Virgo collaboration has published a study of the mass function with pure in-body simulations. And they claim that if you look at the mass function in certain variables, that it's universal over redshift and at least across cosmologies, at least the cosmologies that they have tested. And you can see this is a plot of their mass function versus this is sigma, this RMS again, sigma to the minus 1. You can think of this as mass increasing to the right, because mass is just proportional to mass and sigma are simply related. The relation follows from the power spectrum. The perhaps more interesting plot, which I couldn't fit on here and still make this readable, is the deviations between their best fitting function, which is this dotted line, and all these cluster mass functions, which are, again, come from a variety of redshifts, a variety of cosmological models. The deviations are all less than about 20%, and the RMS is quite small. So it's pretty convincing evidence that they found some sort of universal mass function, although they don't provide a good theoretical understanding of why one should expect that universal mass function. Although their best fitting function is similar to the Sheth and Torman ellipsoidal collapse correction to Press Schechter. So maybe things will, I mean, this is something to watch over time. But just as NFW has sort of hung together, although it also couldn't be derived, you know, from statistical mechanics, you had to use the simulations to people use simulations to get to this NFW universal mass profile. So maybe there's some level of discomfort because it couldn't be derived directly using maybe statistical mechanics or some sort of analytic tool. But nevertheless, it appears to be correct, and we may see that this universal mass function will also turn out to be correct. And if so, that'll be a nice simplification of this whole issue of calculating how the abundance of clusters is expected to evolve. So my view of the situation is that the dark matter properties of galaxy clusters are pretty well understood, with the important caveat that at least the dark matter properties within CDM cosmogony. And the important caveat is that there appear to be some problems with CDM now. Not on cluster scales. There are no clear, believable observations which show that the NFW profile isn't a good fit to galaxy clusters, but on galaxy scales, dwarf ellipticals appear to have a problem, not be well described by the NFW profile. So we have to sort of keep our eyes open for that. The third and perhaps trickiest, at least in my view, part of estimating cluster yields is understanding what the limiting detectable mass is for a particular survey as a function of redshift. Now, for weak lensing surveys, this is a direct probe of dark matter, and so this is a nice, clean way to do cluster surveys. The problem with weak lensing surveys is they tend to be relatively shallow in redshift, at least for the magnitude distributions, the magnitude ranges that are currently used in weak lensing surveys. So that I think the fundamental limit there is the image quality, which will not the size of the telescope, and people are working very hard to improve the image quality. So it could well be that that cluster surveys could push to meaningfully high redshifts with weak lensing. X-ray surveys are something that's near and dear to me, and that they probe the intercluster medium, so the gas within the cluster as opposed to the dark matter. So you have to have some relation between a dark matter dominated property, the virial mass of the cluster, because the intercluster medium is only about 10% of the mass of galaxy clusters for values of H that are reasonable. You have to have some relation between the observable, say the X-ray luminosity, and the dark matter properties of the cluster in order to understand or use an X-ray survey to do cosmology. And typically, I'll show you later that this LX is a particularly poorly behaved quantity cluster because it's a density squared weighted quantity. So it's very weighted to the core of the cluster. So typically you want to have a measured emission weighted temperature from the cluster, which is slightly less weighted to the center. We'll talk about that in a little more detail later. SD surveys are also intercluster medium probes. And so you need some relation between the dark matter property, the dark matter dominated property, MVIR, and in this case, the thermal energy within the virial region. Because the thermal energy is actually the important quantity. If you're calculating the SD flux from a cluster, it simply scales as 1 over the angular diameter distance to the cluster. Because again, the SD decrement along any line of sight through the cluster is independent of the distance to the cluster. It just depends on the line integral of the electron density times the temperature. And so if you take a cluster and move it to higher redshift, the delta T over T doesn't change. But of course, the cluster appears to grow smaller and smaller, and so the flux that you receive from that cluster grows smaller as 1 over the angular diameter distance squared. And then this is the thermal energy, basically. It's the virial mass times the ICM mass fraction times some density-weighted temperature, and then this scaling just turns it to number of electrons times the thermal energy. So in this case, SD surveys are particularly interesting because the cluster evolution, right, as standard in parentheses, the expected cluster evolution offsets this 1 over dA squared, and so the limiting mass appears to be very flat. We expect it to be very flat with redshift. And so SD surveys can detect clusters of a particular mass with equal sensitivity independent of their redshift to some degree. That is a reasonable approximation. Now, SD surveys are interesting, are especially nice relative to X-ray surveys because this thermal energy isn't dominated by the core region of the cluster where the simulations are porous, are expected to break down because of resolution effects and perhaps extra physics like magnetic fields. So this is so we would expect that these SD surveys are going to be less sensitive to complicated physics than X-ray surveys. And optical surveys, well, optical surveys probe the galaxy properties of the cluster. And my sense is good luck. You can't look to the simulations at this point for a lot of help in these optical surveys because you don't form galaxies within simulations. So whereas we can, I'm going to show you and try to argue, and certainly my sense is that we do a pretty good job of reproducing the intercluster medium properties in simulated clusters. Galaxies are still, that's a major focus of work. It's going to take a long time before galaxies are simulated appropriately. And so, whereas optical surveys are great for finding distant clusters, I wonder about how useful they'll be for doing cosmology, because certainly we expect the galaxies within a cluster to be in place long before the cluster actually collapses. And so if you're looking for these, if you have some tool which picks out some over-density of galaxies in the universe, it's going to be sensitive to the cluster, those cluster galaxies, long before the cluster actually forms. And that makes calculating these cluster abundances very difficult, as you might imagine. Okay, so observational reasons for optimism. Well, one, I just wanted to show you, because I think perhaps, I hope that galaxy cluster surveys are sort of a major focus in the future as the CMB work sort of tails off. and so I wanted to try to give you a sense for the how clusters stand observationally. They're known to be a lot of merging galaxy clusters, and so you can they are messy objects. But nevertheless, there is regularity in galaxy clusters, and I wanted to show you that, show you some observations. So I thought I would start with the worst possible observation. So there's large scatter here in the luminosity-temperature relation of galaxy clusters, and that is because, as pointed out first by Andy Fabian, I believe, there are actually two luminosity-temperature relations for galaxy clusters. There's a luminosity-temperature relation for galaxy clusters that have central cooling instabilities, and it is offset, we call those clusters cooling flow clusters, it is offset from the luminosity temperature relation for the clusters without cooling flows. In this particular set, this is the edge at all flux limited sample of clusters, so it includes a nice mix of galaxy clusters. The offset is about 100% in luminosity. So if you're probing to high redshift, then you have to be worried about this fact that there are actually several different relations, because if the mix of cooling flow and non-cooling flow clusters evolves with redshift, then you might expect some sort of systematic, if you were to be very brave and use the luminosity to try to infer the virial mass of a cluster, which I wouldn't suggest. Let's skip that. There are other relations which are more promising. One is the intercluster medium mass within the virial region as a function of temperature. And so the cooling flow clusters, I believe, are the open pentagons, and the non-cooling flow clusters, the same division I showed you a minute ago in the luminosity temperature relation, non-cooling flow clusters are the filled guys. And you can see there's no offset here. And that can be, that's probably well understood because the mass is dominated at large radius within the virial region, whereas the luminosity, being a density squared weighted quantity, is dominated by the central regions where these cooling instabilities can set up. So the local relation between mass and temperature has a scatter of about 18%, and if you try to correct for the uncertainties in these measurements, the scatter is about 14%. So that's definite evidence for regularity in galaxy clusters. Now, of course, this is the intercluster medium mass. This is actually observable. as opposed to the virial mass. What we'd like to see is the virial mass temperature relation. I'll show you that in a second. But this is reason for optimism, with the one important caveat that the theoretical expectation is that the slope of this relation should be 3/2, and that's the dotted line here, whereas the real slope is squared, t squared. Excuse me? You do use the X-ray temperature, but the emissivity within the ROSAT PSPC band is basically temperature independent. So these are truly independent quantities. I mean, to reasonably high approximation. You do use the...
I've seen a lot of pictures from Chandra, the double SD, that show large temperature asymmetry, you know, order across the cluster. So can you give us a sense of, I mean, in which case the temperature is reported, for example?
Yes. Well, this is an emission-weighted mean temperature, so it's a photon-weighted temperature measurement, and in a cluster that has temperature structure, it'll be some sort of intermediate measure of the temperature. So the fact that clusters aren't perfectly spherical isothermal objects will introduce scatter in this relation, and that is, in fact, probably what we're seeing here. We are seeing there is real scatter here. We're resolving the scatter. That's right. But the same point that I just made with Eric, that you do not need to know the temperature. The emissivity is very weakly dependent on the temperature. And so this quantity, MICM, is not very temperature dependent. So we don't need to. This is one. If we wanted to know the virial mass, that's what we're really after here, then it would be great. Then you have to have the temperature profile. But for this particular measurement, you don't. Now, this is the local MVIR virial mass temperature relation, where the virial masses are calculated using optical data. Now, the scatter here is quite large. I don't remember exactly what the number is, but the scatter is actually quite reasonable if you go in and throw out these clusters that they have plotted in gray. But that's not a really fair thing to do. These are early days, and with XMM and Chandra, we'll be able to replace this M200 from optical with M200 from X-ray, where you actually have measures of the temperature profile, and basically we'll be able to measure this relation to reasonable accuracy. Another approach is to use weak lensing, although Martin has argued that there are other problems associated with weak lensing. The gray ones are classic merger candidates. This is the center of the Shapley supercluster. This is just some well-studied cluster, the cluster that my advisor pounded on for a while. COMA has two big components that are in the process of merging. 754 is a major merger candidate. I don't know about 2256. This one also has clear substructure. 2256 is also merged. Okay. Right. It's just that what we're going to be doing, what we're trying to do is take some observable that we'll be able to access in the high redshift universe, like the emission-weighted mean temperature, and we're trying to infer the virial mass. And I don't know. Maybe this is fair to throw these out. I don't know. The other issue is that the virial mass has large systematics, depending on what. Galaxies are not the way to measure the mass of a cluster. They're one way, but it's not a very high precision way. An X-ray approach is much nicer because you're not limited to 300 photons in the X-ray case, whereas in the optical case you are limited to a few hundred galaxies in the best cases. In the X-ray case, you can just observe. You can get a larger telescope. You can get tens of thousands of photons. You can actually measure the distribution of temperature in the gas. It's a much more promising way. I think this is very nice work. I don't mean to demean it. It's just it's certainly not the last word on this issue. Now, there are some non-parametric studies which show basically that clusters are very regular objects too. Again, these are just the X-ray properties. So this is the isopodal radius discussed by Leisha Verde yesterday. With a particular isopode, you can study the sample of this flux-limited sample of clusters, and you can show that the size of these clusters is tightly correlated to the emission-weighted mean temperature. Again, integrating over all this temperature structure that we know is there in a lot of these clusters. Nevertheless, I mean, so that's a source of the scatter, one source of the scatter, but there is regularity here. The scatter is the intrinsic scatter is about 10%. And that is a very regular object by astronomical terms, by astronomical standards. Elliptical galaxies have similar scatter around the fundamental plane, and they're considered to be very regular objects. And here's some recent evidence, which should be taken with more of a grain of salt than the previous overhead. Which shows the intermediate redshift size temperature relation. Now, this sample is not a flux limited sample. This is a sample that was studied by the CNOT group. So it's possible that we are looking at a biased sample of clusters. But nevertheless, this take it for what it. I guess it's nice that this sample of clusters at least shows that the size temperature relation at intermediate redshift does exist, and the scatter with 11 points is consistent with the local scatter. Although that's not a very strong statement with 11 points. Okay, so clusters are regular. That's what the observations suggest. And that gives me some optimism in this whole approach of using cluster surveys to do cosmology. So again, the cosmological sensitivity comes from our sensitivity to the growth factor for density perturbations, how the abundance evolves over time, to the volume that we're surveying as per solid angle. So this is the distance redshift relation. The same thing that the supernova type 1A studies are sensitive to, and this detection threshold or limiting mass. Here are some abundance, so cluster survey yield, DNDZ per square degree as a function of redshift for a particularly sensitive interferometric survey, which is proposed by John Karlstrom and collaborators. This is the limiting mass as a function of redshift for this particular survey, and you can see that it's relatively constant at about 2 × 10¹⁴ solar masses, which is a low mass cluster or a group. And you can see in three different cosmologies, just plotted here, that the yields are very different, especially, the number of clusters is one thing. It varies radically as you go from omega matter of 1 to low omega universes. And if you actually have the redshift distribution and a large enough survey, you can easily differentiate between a low omega universe with lambda and without, just because basically, I'll talk about that in more detail. Okay, so these are all normalized to produce, using the Vian and Little normalization, to reproduce the local abundance of galaxy clusters above 6.2 keV, which we saw yesterday is biased. But anyway, these are all fixed to produce the right observed number of clusters in the local universe. And depending on cosmology, you expect more or less clusters at high redshift. So a relatively sensitive interferometric survey can really deliver clusters at redshifts of 2 or greater. That's kind of exciting. Two planned cluster surveys and cosmological constraints. I don't have an idea. 5 minutes. So let me just zip through this. So the first survey I was going to talk about is this Karlstrom proposed survey. The important fact is just that it's a very sensitive survey. It picks up low mass clusters at any redshift. The second survey I want to talk about a little bit is a large solid angle X-ray survey, and this is a low redshift survey. Notice the redshift range here. So this is the yield for a variety of cosmological parameters for this particular X-ray survey. And you can see we're only picking up clusters out to a redshift of 0.8 or so. So this is a local survey. This is nice because it's coupled to the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, and so we naturally get the redshifts out to about 0.65 for all of these clusters without going to the telescope. The yield here is about 10,000 clusters, so you wouldn't want to have to actually follow up 10,000 clusters, and about 1,000 of them have measured temperatures. You can right away see the power of the SC survey relative to the X-ray. Now, this is a plot of the limiting mass as a function of redshift For the X-ray survey, you can see it rises rapidly. You're just sensitive. I mean, as you get larger and larger telescopes, of course, these limits go down, but you still get this behavior of a rapidly rising mass limit with redshift, whereas the SC surveys, in comparison, have very flat mass limits. So SC surveys are nice ways to probe the high redshift universe. Let me very briefly describe some work done by Zoltan Hyman and Gil Holder and me, where we tried to use these two surveys and ask only from a statistical, within a statistical context, so ignoring systematics, how well can we measure cosmological parameters if we assume the universe has this fiducial cosmology, so a lambda CDM universe with H of 0.7, sigma 8 of 1, and then we basically explore the differences between the cluster yield in this particular case and cluster yields in other cosmologies with different values of omega matter and W.
How much of the survey differs?
These two that I'm talking about, the SC survey is very small but very deep, so it's 12 square degrees. The X-ray survey is shallow but 10,000 square degrees. So there's sort of the two extremes that Bill mentioned yesterday. So these are yield curves, just to give you a feeling. Yield curves for the SC survey as a function of W. So we have omega matter fixed to 0.3, omega lambda to 0.7, and I have three different values of W, minus 1, minus 0.6, and minus 0.2, where W is this equation of state parameter for this dark energy component. And you can see that in the low WK, let's say low W case, you basically the shape varies. If you had redshifts measured for all these clusters, you might hope to differentiate between the lambda case and the W of minus 0.2 case. Now, what's happening here? Well, basically we have two effects in this case because I have the limiting mass is fixed as a function of redshift. One is how the co-moving number density of clusters is changing, how the abundance is changing, and that's plotted here, normalized to the lambda model. So the lambda model is a flat line here at 1. And the W of minus 0.2 case, cluster density perturbations evolve very slowly within that model. And so as you push to higher and higher redshift, the number of clusters you expect, remember we're normalizing at redshift 0, the number of clusters you expect in that model rises very rapidly compared to the number of clusters you expect in the lambda model. So that's one effect. The other is the volume surveyed. And this is the volume in the W of minus 0.2 case as a function of redshift relative to the lambda model volume. So as you go to high W, you get less volume, but density perturbations grow more slowly, and so as you look back in the universe, the clusters disappear less quickly. And these two are sort of offsetting effects, and at low redshift, the volume effect wins, so you get less clusters in the minus 0.2 model than in the lambda case. But at high redshift, cluster density perturbation growth or abundance evolution wins out, and so you expect many more clusters at high redshift in the high W case. So this is the kind of, and you could quantify these differences by integrating over these curves and just comparing the total number of clusters, and also just doing a sort of KS test to compare the shapes of these curves. And that's in fact what we've done. You can make similar curves for W, and just very rapidly, let me point out that the shape difference as you change W, change omega matter, keeping W fixed, is basically as you go to lower omega, the number of clusters you see at every redshift increases. So it's a very, very different character, changes in W and changes in omega matter, and that leads us to the obvious conclusion that you can differentiate between these two simultaneously in a survey. Yes, that would be, that is a problem. I mean, that's if you don't know your minimum mass, then you're in trouble. So you're always going to have to be using simulations hand in hand with the data when interpreting these surveys. I'll very briefly touch on one possible problem there. And so here are some constraints in the omega matter versus W plane for fixed H. for the X-ray survey, so several thousand clusters, and you can see that we're doing, this is the 1 sigma, 2 sigma, 3 sigma region, and we have, again, these are just statistical, we just use statistics to calculate these confidence regions. We haven't included the systematics. We're in the process of doing that. But the striking thing is that there's a lot of information in a cluster survey. What we have here are, let's see, this is a constant distance to redshift of 1 measured with a type 1a supernova, and this is the plus or minus 1% uncertainty on that distance. So you can see our measurement is comparable to, with this survey, is comparable to a 1% measurement of the distance to redshift 1. And here is a constant position of the first peak in the CMB, plus or minus 1%. So a cluster survey potentially is high precision. And moreover, notice that the degeneracies here in the CMB and the supernovae are quite different than the degeneracies in the cluster surveys, because we're not only sensitive to the volume redshift relation or distance redshift relation, which is driving these two guys, we're sensitive to the growth of density perturbation. So it's a fundamentally different kind of measurement. And so coupled with any of these other measurements, which are certainly going to happen, we can strengthen our constraints on these parameters. Very briefly, yesterday it came up, what use is a cluster survey without redshifts? Well, it is useful. Here is the X-ray survey with no redshifts, so just using the total number of clusters observed. And this is the redshift survey just using the redshift distribution observed. And you can see that there is a large, long, skinny parameter degeneracy in this case. And because it's not exactly parallel to the parameter degeneracy in the redshift distribution case, you get very much improved constraints if you have both redshifts and total number. But you're not, this is nothing to scoff at. I mean, this is quite a nice measurement too. If you're just stuck with several thousand clusters with no redshifts, you're still going to be able to say something about cosmology. So, a couple more minutes. I just want to show you this preheating result. It's a way of addressing the systematics that will limit these cosmological constraints. Now, because we depend on the numerical simulations to connect the dark matter properties to the intercluster medium observables, then it's only fair that we ask, well, why are all the simulated scaling relations wrong? Why do we get the slopes wrong in these scaling relations? And if we do, then to what extent can we really trust these simulations to help us understand our mass limit as a function of redshift? Well, one possible solution to getting these scaling relations wrong is a missing bit of physics, which is called preheating, that Martin discussed yesterday. And I wanted to show you some early results from some work that I'm doing in collaboration with John Bialik and Gus Everard at the University of Michigan. And this shows the thermal energy in the intercluster medium as a function of virial mass, or let's say M200, for 5 different models of preheating. So there's the case where the cluster gas starts off very cool, and then this most extreme case where it starts off very hot. Now, we start our gas off hot at the very beginning of the simulation at a redshift of 22. This is comparable to Martin's approach of reheating at a redshift of 7. And I give the equivalent preheating temperature. So we have this is our 1.1 keV model, comparable to Martin's. Now, by comparing scaling relations, mass temperature, size temperature in the local universe, luminosity temperature, we can rule out most of these models. And in fact, we can show that these two very modest preheating models are enough to reproduce the scaling relations and to cause the scaling relations in the simulations to be the same as the scaling relations that are observed. This is kind of fun. Now, you could ask, what effect would preheating have on a cluster survey? And you could take the sort of the dumbest approach possible, which is, let's just say we use we calibrate our survey using simulations that have no preheating when we know in the universe there is preheating. Now, how much would that change the mass limit? Well, these are the two preferred models of preheating. This is the no preheating model. And this is the ratio of the mass limit in this particular preheating model to the mass limit in the no preheating model as a function of mass. So you can see for very high mass clusters at these modest preheating levels, there's very little effect on the cluster structure. But as you go to lower and lower mass clusters, you have a larger and larger effect. So this is a problem with the very sensitive SC surveys where you're probing down in this low mass regime. You're going to be more sensitive to this extra bit of physics, whereas these very shallow and wide surveys up here are going to be less sensitive. And this is just the 1 keV or 1.1 keV preheating model, so it's very extreme. It can already be ruled out. One more plot. So here's the effect of preheating on the yield from a high sensitivity survey, so the mass limit of 2 10 to the 14. You can see I've switched colors on you, but this is the extreme model, so it has a huge effect. But the models that are actually consistent with observations are these two models. So we can ask, what is the difference in yield between these two models and this no preheating case? And it's 8 to 16% effect at this low mass limit. And that's comparable to 1.5 to 3 sigma shift in our confidence region. So that's important. It's larger than our statistical uncertainties. But in absolute terms, it's a very small bias in omega matter of a few hundredths, because omega matter is very... the yield is so sensitive to omega matter that insulates us from these effects. Here is for the low sensitivity case, so 60 square degree Akbar survey. Here we just have a 4 to 8% effect. Now, the mass limit is much less sensitive to preheating for high mass clusters, but the mass function of clusters is dropping much more steeply, and so they offset. Yes, so. Anyway, it's just a few hundredths also. So the indications are that this systematic effect of preheating will not be very important, will not place a very important limitation on the precision of SC surveys, to do cosmological precision of SC surveys. So these are the things I talked about. The specific preheating models. So if we totally ignore preheating, then we'll introduce an error in omega matter at the level of a few hundredths. But there's clearly more work to be done. This is very early. This is very early time. It'll be nice to see how Martin's simulations, what sort of results they produce, and how they compare to ours. So thank you very much. Eric?
If you knew omega matter, the high precision, would this kind of survey be a good way to test the Gaussian energy of fluctuation?
Yeah, that's right. Be a great way. But we heard yesterday that Gaussianity is not an important thing to test. Where's Douglas? Right, the energy required would be quite different. It could be. It's just the issue, it makes sense to have preheating in the sense that galaxies form earlier than clusters. And so if the real source of this extra energy, the source of the metals we see in the intercluster medium, is from galaxy formation, that may be wrong, but if that's the primary source, then we would expect that injection to happen before the clusters form. That's right. That's Chris Metzler's work. Right. So that's another approach. It gives very... Well, it gives qualitatively similar results. Now, we haven't looked at how the effects on cluster surveys would change if you do pre- or post-heating. It is an open question, but I don't see it as an insurmountable issue. It's not going to fundamentally limit these cosmological, these cluster surveys, their power to do cosmology, because in the end, if you totally ignore this effect, it's just a few hundredths on omega matter. It'd be nice to know omega matter to a few hundredths. That? Okay. Okay. I think that's a fair criticism. I think the clear difference is that 20 years later, we now can simulate clusters which reproduce the properties of observed clusters to reasonable accuracy, and that accuracy is going to be improving over time. And we're still stuck without being able to understand how galaxies form. We still can't form galaxies. 20 years from now, maybe someone will be able to form a galaxy. Then, in that case, if we could do a self-consistent formation of galaxies, then one might hope to do cosmology and at the same time account for the abundance evolution in galaxies. Clusters are very different objects. I mean, they're simpler because they're more massive and more gravity dominated. The other physics is less important. Well, I could also comment maybe first. This issue of isothermality is, I tried to address it. It's a red herring. Clusters are not isothermal. We just have to get over that. I mean, that clusters are complicated objects. They're not isothermal spheres. We've got to move on. We've got simulations that can show us what the structure of clusters are. Now, these simulations, both the preheating and the non-preheating cases, the cluster structure evolves in the standard way. Basically coupled, the evolution is coupled to the evolution of the background density. Now that's a bit, in the preheating case, that's still an open question, but it's certainly, that scaling relation I showed you between thermal energy and temperature, this guy, would be a total scatter diagram. All these low mass clusters come from high redshift. It'd be a complete scatter diagram if I did not include the correction for the evolution of structure, for the change in the density of the universe. So I have applied the standard evolution correction to these guys. And you can see, certainly the scatter is greatly reduced. It's yet to be seen whether the standard evolution model is exactly correct for these preheating models. So we understand how clusters evolve with redshift, at least to a reasonable degree. Sorry, Martin, you're going to have a different...
No, actually, I agree with you that we haven't nailed down everything yet.
That's true.
All those issues aside, I think the power of these expertise are
yes.